Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
A new book called Fight the Power looks at the long history of police brutality in New York City. The author is Clarence Taylor, professor emeritus at the CUNY Graduate Center and Baruch College. My name is Beth Harpaz. I'm the EDU. We showcase work from the CUNY community, like Professor Taylor's book. Today, I'll be talking with him about police brutality and the NYPD for a podcast hosted by the Gotham Center for New York City History and New Books Network. Hi, Professor Taylor, and thanks for talking to me today about your new book, Fight the Power.
Yes, hello, and thank you for having me on.
I want to start by mentioning the Black Lives Matter movement, which has done a really good job of bringing attention to killings involving the police in the last few years, including, of course, Michael Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York City. But your book takes a much longer view, and maybe for some readers, might be surprising that there are so many instances in which people of color have been killed by police in New York City. We're not talking about Bull Connor in Birmingham, Alabama, ordering attacks on civil rights protesters in the 1960s. Your book documents dozens of cases across the 20th century into the present day in which people of color died at the hands of the NYPD. Give us an overview of the time frame that you looked at. Why did you choose that time frame? And why does this perspective matter?
Well, the time frame that I focus on in this book is from the 1940s up to the present. And the reason I chose the 1940s, I could have gone back even earlier. I could have gone back to the period when police departments were being created in the late 19th century, professional police departments. But I chose this period because this is when you have the explosion in the Black population in New York, thanks to the Black migration, thanks to folks coming from the Caribbean into the city. And so you see the growth of Harlem, you see the growth of Bedford-Stuyvesant. And this is when you really start having a organized attempt to take on police brutality in the city from various groups that really get very little attention. Other scholars have written about police brutality. They have focused on, the horrific conditions that Blacks face at the hands of the police. But this book focuses on not only these incidents, but how Black African-American, Black folks in New York City organized to take on police brutality.
One of the most interesting sections of the book looks at how newspapers that served the Black community covered police violence, specifically in the 20th century. Now, this is not only before cell phones, so, there's no video for onlookers to be collecting to show us what happened. But a lot of the accounts that you reference were published before everybody had a TV in their living room, right? And then even after, most people had TVs at home, Black communities still were not getting their stories stories told. So how did the black media fill that gap? What were some of those newspapers called? And how did those reporters establish credibility for the stories that they were telling about incidents of police brutality?
Yeah, you are absolutely correct. You know, many people think that police brutality is a recent phenomenon, thanks to cell phones, thanks to video recorders. But as you note, this is a long history and completely ignored by those in power, ignored by the law enforcement. In fact, many made the argument there was no such thing as police brutality. That was an excuse used by criminals. But African Americans, of course, as the victims, said, look, we really have to launch an effort to stop being brutalized, stop being killed by police officers, because it was a major problem and still is a major problem. The black press was one of the most important institutions taking on police brutality. In New York City, there were a number of black publications. You know, the Amsterdam News, one of the longest black publications still in existence today. You had the New York Age. You had the Crisis, which was a national paper, a magazine, but headquartered in New York City. That was the organ of the NAACP. But the paper that I focus on in this book is one that many people never heard of, and that is The People's Voice. This was a paper organized by the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell Jr.
Famous name.
Famous name, that's right, who became the pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church, perhaps the largest black church in the nation. At one point, by the 1950s, claiming 10,000 members. But back in the 1940s, Powell created The People's Voice because he wanted to move away from the sensationalism that many other black publications really focused on. He said he wants to focus on the conditions of Harlem, and one of those conditions was police brutality. This paper, and like many other black newspapers, didn't only just report on police brutality. They became leading forces to challenge police brutality. They were part of what I call the anti-police brutality movement in New York City. So what the Voice did and other papers did was not only just tell the story, but they would take the side of the victim. They would challenge the police reports, the police narrative of the event. Very critical police narratives. They would go out, and the People's Voice is very good at this. They would get witnesses, what they called impartial witnesses, who weren't members of people's family, but who just happened to be on the scene of a police brutality incident, and get their stories. Of course, they would take the victim's stories, but in some cases, some of these victims were killed by police, right? So they would always have someone who was someone who they said was impartial, an eyewitness to the event. In addition to this, the black press came up with ways of taking on police brutality. They never classified it as just rogue cops. They said, no, this was essentially a problem of the department. Mm-hmm. And in particular, it was a problem of power. that the police had overwhelming power over the citizens, and the citizens clearly needed some avenues of relief in order to, you know, challenge that power. So the black press was, you know, they kept the story alive. You know, that was another way of doing it. They just didn't just drop the report. They or talk about the incident at one time. I mean, they kept it in the news constantly until they can essentially get justice in case of people's voice. And they even organized rallies and demonstrations. So I think this was unusual for newspapers, right?
Right, yeah, right. They were truly advocates for their readers, and they were trying to hold these institutions accountable. You know, like you say, they weren't just saying, "Oh, this is what happened." They were, you know, precisely saying, "This is a systemic problem, and we need systemic answers." One of the things, I'm a former journalist. I worked for the Associated Press for almost 30 years. One of the things that was so interesting in what you wrote was, when they would interview witnesses, they almost went about it like a lawyer would present a witness to a jury by establishing credibility for this person. And I loved your description of, you know, they would say, well, Mr. So-and-so was an eyewitness and, you know, he's however many years old he is, and he works at a hotel, and the people at the hotel say he's a very reliable worker. Like, they would make sure that every person they interviewed, you know, was a fine and upstanding citizen, so therefore what they say can be trusted. And yes, I just thought that that was just a really interesting way for them to do this kind of journalism, to create these you know, this credibility for every witness, to make sure that we could trust what this person said, because they knew they were going up against the official account, right, coming from the police department, coming from the city of New York, and that they had to create some kind of a standard by which this alternate account could be judged truthful or acceptable.
That is correct. And I should also note, they also did this for the victims.
Right.
All right, because the police report would always describe the person committing a criminal act.
Right.
And so they would not only have a witness who would tell the story, but they would also point out that this person was not a criminal. This person was not living a criminal life. You know, this is usually was a person who was, you know, upstanding citizen, you know, who had a job, right, who had never been in trouble before, arrested. This was a way of challenging, you know, the sort of dominant police narrative.
Now, you also contend throughout the book that the mainstream New York City media, not the black press, but, you know, the other media, and in, you know, in the mid 20th century, there were many daily newspapers in New York City. We're down to, I guess, basically three or four, but, you know, there were multiple daily newspapers in the 20th century in New York City. And you pretty much contend that, you know, the narrative from the mainstream press actually helped city officials kind of cover up these allegations of wrongdoing by the cops by painting this portrait of black communities as lawless places filled with criminals, and at the same time painting the cops as always right beyond any judgment. What was the impact of that coverage? And if I've summarized it incorrectly, please give your own spin on how you see it all.
Okay, no, you are correct that mainstream press always took the side of the police. You know, they always reported the police version of events. And in this way, reinforcing this notion that communities like Harlem, communities like Bedford-Stuyvesant, predominantly black communities, were just festering with crime. They were loaded with criminals. And so the police had to essentially do their job. And by the way, this is why I argue, this is why police brutality is one of the hardest civil rights issues to address. It's pretty apparent, right? You're a citizen, you should have the right to vote. You're denied the right to vote. That's an infringement on someone's civil rights. But when it comes to police brutality, people don't see it that way, right? It's essentially the police word against those of the victim. And if the victim is portrayed as a criminal, coming from a, quote, criminal race, then it's very difficult to get reforms, right, to bring about change, to get the support of the public. And so newspapers were really crucial in reinforcing this notion of blacks as criminals. By one reporting the story of the police and one just completely ignoring that of the victims.
Right. And you know, I think it maybe is worth sort of underscoring here that, you know, many of these incidents that you recount, a lot of them are just like out of the blue. I mean, it's not like the police were actually responding or, you know, breaking up some crime in progress. You know, sometimes there were, and their response involved excessive force in, you know, arresting the alleged perpetrator or whatever. But a lot of the incidents that you describe, I mean, they just sound like, you know, the cops would just go into a bar or find somebody on a street corner and just get out of control, right?
That is correct. Or they would harass young people in the subways or, you know, just walking on the street. Yeah, this is the problem, I said, of power.
You know, right.
One has, you know, this immense power and it doesn't go, it's not challenged.
Right. And I think, you know, it's amazing. We just have had this incident in New York City with this young woman and her baby in an office where she was waiting to deal with a food stamp application. And she sat on the floor, according to the various accounts I've read, and the security folks in the food stamps office didn't want her to sit on the floor. She got in an argument with them. Somebody called the cops. And now you have this video of the cops, you know, wrenching this little baby, this baby out of her arms. I mean, if you saw a parent pulling a baby like that out of somebody else's arms, that parent would be charged with child abuse. I mean, I'm stunned that kid's arm wasn't dislocated. And so I, you know, if people kind of, and I say this because I think sometimes in these cases where there's allegations of police brutality, what the cops and the officials always say is, oh, well, that person was, you know, they were committing a crime or there was a, you know, there was some kind of an altercation involved. And I feel like this video of this young woman in the food stamps office is like, she's like the poster child for like, she didn't do anything wrong. And these people are coming in there, you know, gangbusters. And I think it's a very good example of, you know, of the kinds of things that, you know, that we're talking about, although she wasn't injured. And of course, in the cases that you're documenting, you know, there were horrific injuries and deaths at the hands of the police. And this kind of brings me to my next question, which is about mayors, because they're an important part of the problem and the potential solution here. Historically, New York City mayors, criticize the NYPD at their peril. Look at Mayor de Blasio. He basically ended stop and frisk as we know it. Then he goes to a police funeral and hundreds of police officers turn their backs on him. And we noticed in this most recent interview with this young woman in the food stamps office, he was very reluctant to criticize the cops. He finally said something on Twitter, but it was a very muted, well, this is disturbing and we'll have to investigate. I guess there have been a few mayors over the decades who have tried to establish ways to hold police accountable for wrongful deaths of civilians and other brutality incidents, but it hasn't gone well. And I wondered if you would talk about that, especially Mayor Lindsay and the Civilian Complaint Review Board and how that's evolved over the years. I know Mayor Lindsay's tenure is a specialty of yours.
Yes. Lindsay attempted to take on police brutality. There was a major campaign, as I note in the book, for a Civilian Complaint Review Board. And people define that Civilian Complaint Review Board, the advocates of it, as one having power to investigate and then deciding on the punishment of police officers. They should also have the power of subpoena to call witnesses. And this is what civil rights groups, grassroots organizations all pushed for. And they did have some support by the mid-1960s from some elected officials. One of them was not Mayor Robert Wagner. He was completely opposed to this. He essentially took the side of the police when it came to the Civilian Complaint Review Board. John Lindsay stepped up to run for mayor in 1965, and he said the first thing that he would do as mayor was create a predominantly Civilian Complaint Review Board, that is four civilians and three police officers.
And until then, the CCRB or whatever panel existed, it was just staffed by people from the police department.
That
right?
is true. They had three deputy police commissioners running what they called the Civilian Complaint Review Board.
So they were reviewing complaints by civilians, but they were the police, basically.
That's right. Totally.
Investigating the police. There were no civilians who were, you know, part of this agency to hold police accountable or conduct independent investigations at that point.
That's right. That's right. No civilians on this earlier board that was created in the early 1950s. But Lindsay stepped forward and said that he would create this essentially a compromise. You know, it was a moderate boy. He wasn't throwing all police officers off. That's what civil rights organizations wanted. They wanted an all civilian complaint review board. And Lindsay said, no, we'll have three police officers and four civilians. But that was even too much for the police. And their organization, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, organized a racist campaign to do away with this review board. Through executive orders, Lindsay created a civilian complaint review board, and the police launched this campaign, including going to court, arguing that it was illegal, and they organize a referendum campaign. And they scared people, in particular white New Yorkers, by making the argument, and which I call the false narrative, that if you create this review board, it's going to tie the hands of the police, and the criminals are going to essentially get the upper hand. They are going to win the day. And that worked. And so when at the end of the day, the referendum was actually voted in support of, that is doing away with this Lindsay's Civilian Complaint Review Board. Now, what's important about that that campaign, I argue, police gain an extraordinary amount of political power. I mean, they stepped out in the political arena. Right. And they had this false narrative that if you attempted to go after them and attempt to make them, quote, accountable, you are tying their hands and essentially you are supporting criminals. And they have been using that argument ever since. So that's what de Blasio faced when he attempted to put forth his police reform agenda. And of course, this is shortly after he curtailed, stop, question, and frisk by essentially enforcing a court decision, right? Saying I will, uphold the court decision, I will drop the appeals of the city to challenge this court decision that said you have to stop racial profiling when it comes to stop, question, and frisk.
Right, and you have to have a reason. You can't just stop every young black guy that walks on the street. You have to fill out forms, and there has to be a reasonable cause, etc.
That's right, and of course, he attempted to be sympathetic to the family and criticize the police. And that's when the police sort of organized this campaign to go after him. And then after the assassination of two police officers.
So let's talk about Eric Garner for a minute. Tell us what happened with that and how that played into Mayor de Blasio's relationship with the cops.
Yes. One of the killings under Mayor de Blasio was that of Eric Garner in Staten Island, a young man who was accused of selling, quote, Lucy's, buying packs of cigarettes, taking the cigarettes out and selling them to make a profit. This fell under this category of sort of broken windows policy, you know, sort of small, you have to stop small crimes before they explode into larger ones. And so when he was confronted by police, accused of selling cigarettes, and there's lots of questions whether he was doing that or not. Witnesses said he was not selling cigarettes, but said he was breaking up a fight. Police officers restrained him when he asked them to leave him alone. And of course, one police officer, Daniel Pantaleo, used an illegal chokehold, and Eric Garner died on scene. Of course, there were protests in New York City. The mayor came out and spoke and said it was a horrendous killing, and the PBA became very upset with the mayor, criticized him. And then shortly after, two police officers who were sitting in a patrol car were shot to death by some crazed man. And the police used that campaign and said that he is creating the atmosphere of just allowing the criminals to run wild. In fact, Patrick Lynch, head of the PBA, claimed that the mayor had blood on his hands. So it's this campaign, along with the visible protests by the police, the police officers, the two police officers were shot at their funeral, where they turned their back on the police, that curtail the mayor's police reform agenda. He sort of backed away from that.
He absolutely did. Yeah. And what is the, do you know what the makeup of the Civilian Complaint Review Board is today in terms of civilians versus cops?
Oh, yeah, it's all civilians.
It's all civilians, okay.
Yeah, that was changed under David Dinkins.
Okay. And so that certainly seems like, you know, there's been at least that much progress, right? Go ahead.
Well, when Dinkins pushed with the support of the city council for an all civilian complaint review board, there were massive protests. One led by his challenger, Rudolph Giuliani. And this became an extremely nasty protest where you had off duty police officers using the N-word when referring to Dinkins, pulling passengers, in particular black passengers, from cars and beating them, while you had on-duty police officers not doing anything about it. Dinkins made it clear that it was Giuliani who was responsible, because Giuliani spoke at a demonstration of these police officers, riling them up, saying that Dinkins is the cause of your problems. So Dinkins lost his re-election. I mean, he ran again and he lost to Giuliani. And then that's when the All Civilian Complaint Review Board went into effect. And what did Giuliani do? He tried to starve it. He just sort of
didn't give it the resources they needed to do the investigation.
So they didn't hire enough investigators.
Yeah.
To conduct their, essentially conduct their affairs. So, yeah, I mean, it had the Civilian Complaint Review Board has had a turbulent history in New York City. And, yeah, recently it has gained more power. But, you know, there are those who are calling it, you know, it should have complete power to make decisions of on when they not just recommend, but they should be able to essentially enforce penalties against police officers.
Right. And it's probably worth noting that the officer who was involved in the Eric Garner case, Pantaleo, I believe he's still on the payroll of the NYPD. The case, I think, is going to be in court in 2019, right?
That is correct, and he did get his back pay, by the way, when he was suspended.
Yeah,
it was people to criticize the mayor for that.
Yeah, and it, you know, and again, worth saying that a lot of these cases, which seem so, you know, the public and advocates for people of color and Black Lives Matter movement, you know, on the one side, a lot of us will look at these videos or hear the details of these cases and say, like, this is obviously police brutality, et cetera, et cetera. It works its way through the system. And many times, you know, the police are acquitted. Juries often accept the argument that the police are doing their jobs in a situation or that they acted in a reasonable manner because, you know, they thought the person had a weapon or, you know, whatever. So what, you know, what might seem to the public like a kind of a cut and dried case, it doesn't always play out the way public sentiment at this point in our history, you know, I think the public sentiment is often on the side of the, you know, the victim. And it just, once things go through the system, it doesn't always end up with what, you know, advocates might feel is a just outcome, right?
No, I agree with you. And, you know, so this also gets to the heart of, you know, De Blasio's reforms, right? He did curtail stop, question, and frisk. But he is a strong supporter for broken windows. He has not backed off of that.
Right. And for listeners who may not know, you know, exactly what that is, that's a policy that developed, you know, a couple of decades ago when New York was not such a bright and shiny place. We had a lot of abandoned buildings and, you know, very high crime rate. And there was this philosophy that, you know, if there was a broken window in a building, that could create an atmosphere of neglect, which could lead to criminal activity. So that sort of enabled or led to this policy on the part of the police department that any minor infraction, you know, somebody drinking a can of beer in public or, you know, public urinating or, you know, riding a bike on the sidewalk, that any little infraction of, you know, any minor, you know, public regulation, that they had the right to, you know, kind of hit that person with the full force of the law. And in fact, the broken windows, the housing department at one point literally like painted pictures on windows of abandoned buildings and to make them look like they were occupied. They painted little window boxes and curtains and stuff. It was truly surreal. Like, we'll just pretend that people live in this building and it's well cared for, and somehow, you know, that will become reality.
Yeah, that's right. And people don't realize the number of minor offenses people could get citations for and arrested. You know,
right.
And so, I mean, you could be on the subway and you can have a knapsack and a seat that's not occupied, and even the car is not crowded, you know, one can wind up getting in trouble
Absolutely. My husband was walking our dog in Prospect Park one night, not deep in the park, but literally just on the edge of the park next to the sidewalk. It was 5 minutes after midnight, and he was given a citation for being in the park after midnight. He like literally was had one foot inside the park on a patch of grass with the dog at 5 minutes after midnight. Furthermore, he had no ID on him, which was another whole, you know, infraction because we live around the corner. Who knew that that was a crime? But under this policy, he had to go to court and see this thing through and I think pay a fine or something.
That's right. Criminalizing a whole bunch of normal behavior.
Normal activity, exactly. So what are your thoughts at this point on progress in curbing police brutality? I was in touch recently with Alex Vitale, another CUNY professor who wrote a fantastic book called The End of Policing. He does a lot of research on police brutality. And he sent me this great chart, which I don't have the figures in front of me, but he said, you know, the number of people who have died at the hands of New York police has dropped substantially over the years. Cases may be a lot more controversial and they may stay in the news longer because we do have cell phone video now. We're not just relying on the black press of the mid 20th century to give us these non-official accounts, right? There's, I think, a greater understanding of the way in which people of color in general are, you know, maybe abused by the criminal justice system. And I just wonder, you know, what are your thoughts on this kind of overall? Are you heartened at all, or is there still such a long way to go? What's your take on where we are now, maybe compared to where we were, and maybe compared to where you'd like to see us go?
Yes. Alex is right. In terms of people being killed by the police, that has dramatically gone down. But police brutality is larger than just killings, right? They're the everyday offenses that take place. People arrested for, we were just talking about what you call normal activities. There's clearly progress. I make the argument. I think de Blasio the police, the anti-police brutality campaign, have made loads of steps. You know, they have won many court decisions, right? There's now monitoring the police, federal monitoring of the police department. There have been these many steps that have taken, but there's still, I guess, there are too many arrests of black and brown people in the city. You can go into any court in Queens or in Brooklyn, and you can see the number of people who have been arrested for any sorts of crimes. You know, marijuana now has become a major focus in the city, where the mayor clearly is opposed to what certain DAs in the city want to do, and not, you know, just arrest people and give them, you know, summonses and so forth. But I find that ironic when I turn around and I see people, also some people who have more money, are making millions of dollars off of marijuana sales. So municipal marijuana and so forth. But I think that there's been progress, but we have to keep pushing on. I'd be pushing on, because that incident that took place, as you described at the beginning, with this young woman having a child snatched from her, too many of those incidents are still taking place in the city, right? The young man who was shot and killed last year in Brooklyn, right, who was a disturbed young man who had a piece of pipe in his hand, and the police went after him and shot him. But it's, you know, not just those horrendous incidents. Like I said, this is a sort of ordinary, everyday incidents that are taking place in the streets of the city that we have to address. And I make the argument, you can't really address that problem unless you decrease the power of the police. Now, I know that's controversial, but the fact that they have this wide range, so people can be police still have a power to arrest people for numerous incidents. And I think that needs to be curtailed. I think we need to empower, give the Civilian Complaint Review Board real power to really address the infractions by police officers. And I recommend other steps in my book that I think the city needs to adopt, not just the city, but throughout the nation. I mean, New York is better than many police departments in the country, but it's not perfect.
All right. Well, we have been talking to Clarence Taylor, Professor Emeritus at Baruch College and the CUNY Graduate Center, about his new book, Fight the Power, African Americans and the Long History of Police Brutality in New York City. Thank you, Professor Taylor, for all this insight and a lot of food for thought here today. Good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
And I'm Beth Harpaz, the editor of the CUNY website, SUM, sum.cuny.edu, signing off for the Gotham Center for New York City History and New Books Network. All right, let me stop.